Picture this. It's the 1967, and a young biologist submits a paper to a prominent scientific journal.
And she is about to make a lot of people very, very angry.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So her claim was that the mitochondria inside our cells, those microscopic powerhouses keeping us alive, were actually the descendants of ancient independent bacteria.
Which at the time sounded completely ridiculous to the establishment.
Right. She argued that billions of years ago, a larger cell basically swallowed a smaller bacteria whole, failed to digest it, and then they started working together.
Yeah, and when she presented this, she wasn't just politely debated, she was essentially laughed out of the room.
I think the paper was rejected, what, 15 times?
Roughly 15, yeah. The scientific community at the time found the concept utterly absurd. I mean, it violated every fundamental assumption they held about how evolution worked.
But she just kept pushing.
Yeah.
And decades later, that young biologist, Lynn Margulis, is remembered as an absolute genius. Her theory is standard textbook knowledge today.
It's a massive turnaround.
It really is. And her story is just the perfect entry point for what we are tackling in today's deep dive. Because today, our mission is to unpack a really fascinating, highly detailed set of notes from a researcher who is exploring a deceptively complex question.
Right, the question of what actually makes a good research question, and how do we go about choosing one?
Exactly. And for you listening, we are really framing this not just as a guide for scientists, but as a masterclass. Think about how you pick your own projects or how you pitch your ideas at work.
Or even how you decide what's worth your own free time to learn or build.
Yeah, exactly. Because choosing what to research or dedicate your life to is a lot like, well, it's like choosing a startup idea or a major life goal. You really need a framework or you'll just end up chasing your own tail, burning all this energy but going absolutely nowhere.
And a functional framework has to start with a solid foundation. Our source notes argue that this foundation is actually entirely subjective. It begins with the researcher themselves.
Which is kind of surprising.
It is. Long before you draft a proposal or seek funding or worry about like changing the world, you have to look inward. You have to ask why the person doing the work actually cares about the topic.
And our source brings up a 2016 article from the journal Science to make this point. It was written by researcher Piotr Wassilczyk and is titled Three Lessons Rarely Taught.
Yeah, and these lessons serve as this incredible internal compass for anyone about to take on a massive unstructured project.
So let's get into them. The first lesson he outlines is just to play around. Try wild, unstructured things in the lab, even if there is no immediate, obvious application for what you are doing.
Which runs completely counter to the stereotypical image we have of strict, stoic scientific inquiry.
Definitely. And then the second lesson is to make sure you are having fun. Wassilczyk notes that one of his own advisors told him science is only worth doing if you are still having fun doing it. He actually advocates for changing your entire research direction if you lose that sense of enjoyment.
Right, and the third lesson is to find what suits you. This acknowledges that intellectual excitement is highly personal.
Right, like a complex data set that thrills an astrophysicist might be totally mind-numbing to a marine biologist.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit because I am going to push back on this significantly.
Go for it.
In highly competitive fields, whether that's academia, tech, medicine, people are fighting for limited grants, right? They want venture capital. Or they're just trying to keep their jobs.
Oh, absolutely. The pressure is immense.
So advising someone to just, play around and have fun, doesn't that sound incredibly naive? I mean, if you spend your time tinkering without a rigid goal, aren't you going to waste years of your life and probably get fired?
It's a super common reaction to hear those words and associate them with a lack of discipline. But Wawelzyk is actually talking about the mechanics of human endurance.
Okay, how so?
Well, the reality of the scientific process, or really any ambitious long-term pursuit, is that it is fundamentally grueling. You are looking at a landscape of constant failure, dead ends, and just repetitive, unglamorous labor.
Yeah, the day-to-day is not glamorous.
Not at all. So if your motivation is entirely external, say, you just want a prestigious title, or you are trying to satisfy a graduation requirement, that motivation shatters the exact moment you hit a major obstacle.
Oh, I see. So you're saying the fun isn't frivolous, it's actually the fuel required to not quit.
Exactly. The intrinsic motivation is the only thing that sustains the effort over years. If you aren't genuinely entertained by the puzzle itself, the failure rate will absolutely break you.
That makes a lot of sense.
And this ties into a specific motto Wassels uses in his lab to test his students' motivations. He asks them, which research project would you start today if you were certain you would succeed?
Oh, wow. That is a brilliant filter. It completely isolates the subject matter from the fear of failure or, you know, the pressure of external expectations. It forces you to admit what you actually care about.
Right. And it also reveals the inherent necessity of risk. If a project is guaranteed to succeed from day one, it probably isn't pushing any real boundaries. A worthwhile project must have a high probability of failure, which is exactly why that intrinsic passion is so critical.
Okay, so let's follow the timeline of this framework.
Yeah.
You look inward, you identify your passion, and you find a concept you find deeply fun and inherently risky.
Step one complete.
Right. But then you step out of your own head and confront physical reality. You have to ask, can I actually execute this?
And that brings us to the second major criterion in our source notes, which is feasibility.
And the source makes a vital distinction here about how to define feasibility. It is not about whether the ultimate distant goal is possible. You are absolutely allowed to have an incredibly ambitious, borderline impossible end goal.
Yeah, the dream can be massive.
But feasibility is strictly asking whether you have or can establish the relevant experimental system to take the initial steps. Like, do you currently possess the means and the expertise to just begin?
Right.
So it's like deciding you want to build a rocket to Mars. That's the ambitious goal. But feasibility isn't asking if I know how to shield astronauts from cosmic radiation for 9 months. It's asking, do I even own a wrench?
Yes. Perfect analogy.
Can I even replicate a basic combustion engine in my backyard first? If I don't even have the fundamental tools to start, the Mars goal is completely irrelevant.
That captures the distinction perfectly. And in the context of scientific research, acquiring that wrench or that basic engine often means relying on what other people have already built.
Yeah.
You rarely start from absolute zero.
Right. You stand on the shoulders of giants.
Exactly. You look at a published paper, you see a methodology that produced an interesting result, and you plan to base your new project on that existing system.
But the source issues a massive warning right here. It is a fatal error to blindly build your multi-year project on someone else's published work without verifying that you can actually reproduce their results first.
Yes, and this touches on one of the most critical issues in modern science. It's known as the reproducibility crisis.
I've heard of this.
It's a huge deal. A frighteningly high percentage of published peer-reviewed findings simply cannot be replicated when other laboratories try to run the exact same experiment.
Wait, I want to understand the mechanics of this crisis. Are researchers routinely faking their data just to get published?
Outright. Malicious fraud is statistically pretty rare, actually. The crisis stems from much more subtle systemic issues.
Like what?
Well, often the failure to reproduce is due to an absence of granular details in the written methodology. The original researchers might have used a highly specific reagent or stirred a solution for a very specific duration at a precise room temperature.
And they just forget to write that down.
They leave those details out of the publication because it feels like second nature to them. It's obvious to them.
Right.
But when another lab tries it without those hidden variables, the experiment just fails.
So the knowledge is almost trapped in the original researcher's muscle memory.
Yes, exactly. And another major culprit is poor statistical analysis in the original paper.
Okay, how does that work?
A researcher might run an experiment 50 times, get a result that looks like a breakthrough once, and convince themselves that the one anomaly is the true result. They ignore the 49 failures.
Oh, yikes.
Yeah, they publish the noise as a signal. So if you don't take the time to run their protocol in your own lab and confirm you get the same baseline data, you might spend your entire grant funding trying to build a roof on a house that has literally no foundation.
That sounds like a nightmare. And the source also mentions that feasibility is highly contextual, right? It depends heavily on your current career stage. They compare graduate students to undergraduate students to illustrate this.
Let's analyze the graduate student first.
Yeah.
A PhD candidate operates under severe time constraints and intense pressure to produce a novel contribution. They have roughly 4 to 6 years.
The clock is ticking.
Loudly. If their laboratory does not already have established expertise in a highly complex, brand new methodology, attempting to pioneer that method from scratch is incredibly dangerous for them.
Because they just lack the runway, right?
Yeah.
They can't afford to fail for 3 years before finally collecting data.
Exactly. They need a project where the experimental system is largely already in place.
But contrast that with an undergraduate student doing a short summer research stint. They don't have the looming pressure of a dissertation. Our source argues that for an undergrad, attempting to set up a ridiculously difficult, unproven methodological approach can actually be a fantastic idea.
Because the stakes are entirely different. Even if the undergraduate spends the whole summer failing to get the system to work, the sheer act of wrestling with complex protocols is deeply educational.
Right.
However, the source notes a really critical psychological caveat here as well.
The need for an early win.
Yes. Constant grinding failure early on can permanently extinguish a young student's interest in science.
Which goes back to the fun aspect.
Exactly. For many individuals, securing a safe, easily achievable positive result early in their training is the psychological catalyst that convinces them they are even capable of a career in research.
So this loops back to Wasilczyk's third lesson. Find what suits you. You have to accurately assess your own timeline, your resources, and your psychological tolerance for failure to determine what is truly feasible for you at this specific moment.
And once you establish that you possess the passion and the feasible system to execute the project, a new constraint appears. You must assess the broader landscape, because you are rarely the only person capable of asking a specific question.
Ah, right. The tension between playing the long game and running a race. The source introduces a fascinating piece of history here to show that feasibility constraints can sometimes be bent, provided you have the luxury of time. They bring up Max Perutz.
Max Perutz's journey to map the structure of the hemoglobin molecule is a legendary example of the extreme long game.
Hemoglobin is the protein in our red blood cells, right? The one responsible for transporting oxygen.
That's the one. Today we know its structure intimately, but when Perutz began his work in the late 1930s, the concept of mapping a protein was almost unthinkable.
And the source notes, it took him 23 years to finally solve it. 23 years. How do you even sustain funding and career momentum for over two decades without a final result?
Well, he utilized X-ray crystallography, which is a technique involving bouncing X-rays off crystallized molecules to infer their shape from the diffraction patterns.
Sounds incredibly tedious.
Agonizingly slow, iterative work. Many of his contemporaries actually believed he was throwing his career away. They genuinely suspected proteins were just amorphous, wobbly blobs without a fixed, readable structure.
But he kept his funding somehow.
He did. The Medical Research Council in the UK continued to finance his laboratory. They understood that the ultimate goal, understanding the very mechanism of oxygen transport in the human body, was so profoundly important that it justified the massive timeline and the uncertain methodology.
It is a remarkable story.
Yeah.
But the source injects a heavy dose of modern reality immediately after telling it. The current scientific climate is driven by hyper-competition, rapid publication cycles, and constant metric evaluations. Taking a 23-year gamble on an unproven method is nearly impossible for a modern researcher.
Yeah, the environment has fundamentally shifted. Modern researchers must relentlessly pursue novelty, but they have to do it efficiently. This requires an exhaustive literature search before committing to a project.
Because if you step outside your core area of expertise, you run a massive risk of dedicating years to answering a question that a different laboratory actually solved a decade ago.
And even if you confirm the question is completely unanswered, you still have to look at your peers. You have to assess the race.
Right, because the probability of multiple groups converging on the same idea at the same time is extremely high in modern science.
You must objectively ask yourself, how likely is it that three other well-funded labs are chasing this exact same result right now? And if they are, what is our competitive advantage?
Do we possess a proprietary technology, a unique data set, or specialized background knowledge that basically guarantees we will get to the finish line first?
The source leans on a classic article by Bruce Alberts titled, A Wake-Up Call. To address this, Alberts poses a brutally pragmatic question about the nature of research.
What's the question?
He asks, what is the point of addressing a question if someone else will inevitably solve it anyway if you choose not to?
Oh, wow. That forces a really hard evaluation of your own utility. If a discovery is on the verge of happening and several major laboratories are already racing toward it, your participation might be entirely redundant. You aren't adding unique value to the universe. You're basically just fighting for credit.
Exactly.
So let's translate that for you, the listener. Think about how you spend your time at work or in your personal ambitions. Are you engaged in redundant races? Are you dedicating massive energy to a project, filing a report, or building a software feature that someone else in your industry would happily build anyway?
It's a tough mirror to look into.
It really is. The challenge Alberts is throwing down is to find the space where your specific, weird combination of skills and background can produce something that simply would never exist if you didn't decide to build it.
That is the definition of finding your unique leverage point. You are looking for the intersection of your internal passion, physical feasibility, and a gap in the world that only you can fill.
Okay, so assume you hit that intersection. You do the work, you run the long game, and you find a genuinely novel answer. The final hurdle our source covers is communication. How do you get anyone else to actually care about the answer you found?
And this is a point where incredibly brilliant people often fail.
Really?
Yeah. The source addresses a massive misconception about human attention. We operate under the assumption that an audience, whether that is a grant committee, venture capitalists, or just the general public, will care about a finding simply because it is objectively important or significant to society.
Right. The assumption is that if I discover a cure for a rare disease, the sheer objective importance of the cure will compel people to listen to me.
But the data and historical precedent show otherwise. Objective importance is heavily outweighed by emotional connection.
Interesting.
We observe this in our daily societal behaviors. We dedicate massive amounts of time, money, and emotional energy to arts, sports, and entertainment. None of these things are strictly relevant to our physical survival or objective societal progression, yet we care deeply about them.
Because they make us feel something. They resonate with our personal histories or our internal struggles.
Yes. Scientists, despite all their rigorous training, are still governed by human psychology. A researcher cares about their specific subfield because they have a personal, emotional connection to the history of the work, not just because an algorithm declared it the most significant problem.
So to capture an audience's attention, bombarding them with data and declaring your work important is basically ineffective. You must establish an emotional psychological bridge.
Exactly. And the source introduces an essay from 1971 by sociologist Murray S. Davis titled "That's Interesting," which actually provides a structural formula for building that bridge.
Oh, I love a good formula.
Davis explains the mechanics of how an idea sticks in an audience's brain. And he builds his entire theory around a concept he calls the assumption ground.
Okay, let's define the assumption ground clearly.
For an audience to care about any new proposition you bring them, they must possess a foundation of pre-existing knowledge or strong opinions about the topic. That baseline is their assumption ground.
If they don't have that?
If they have zero prior knowledge or lack any opinion on the subject, your new idea will bounce right off them. It is entirely irrelevant because there is nothing for it to anchor to.
So if I walk up to you and deliver a groundbreaking revolutionary fact about the migratory patterns of a specific deep sea flatworm, but you didn't even know that flatworm existed, you aren't going to care.
The proposition dies immediately. You just shrug.
However, Davis's real insight is about what happens after you locate that assumption ground. How do you ensure your new idea is perceived as interesting? According to his formula, a theory is interesting only if it actively denies some part of the audience's routinely held assumption ground.
Oh, so you have to reveal to them that a specific truth they confidently believed is actually incorrect.
Yes.
It functions exactly like a plot twist in a movie. You establish the baseline reality the audience trusts, and then you pull the rug out on one specific detail. You say, you know how we've always assumed X works because of Y? Well, the data shows it's actually Z.
The psychological mechanism at play there is cognitive dissonance. If you present an uninteresting theory, one that simply affirms what the audience already believes their brain, registers it, agrees, and immediately discards it, it requires no further attention.
Makes sense.
But an interesting theory creates a tension that the audience feels compelled to resolve.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, and it leads to the most counterintuitive part of Davis's theory. Because if denying the audience's expectation is good, then presenting a totally 100% revolutionary idea that changes everything should be incredible, right?
You'd think so.
But Davis argues that it's a terrible strategy. Wait, so being totally 100% revolutionary is actually a bad way to get people to listen to you?
It is a disastrous strategy. If your proposition denies the entire assumption ground, if you stand in front of an audience and say, every single thing you have ever believed about this entire field of study is fundamentally false, the audience will not find you interesting. They will find you absurd.
Because you have destroyed the anchor completely. The cognitive dissonance is just too massive for them to process, so their defense mechanism is to just reject you as a lunatic.
The structural difference between genius and lunacy is razor thin, and it is entirely dictated by the audience's assumption ground. You must anchor people in the familiar before you introduce a radical. If you break the entire foundation at once, the establishment will expel you.
Which brings us directly back to the story of Lynn Margulis we started with.
Exactly. Let's look at why her theory was considered absurd. In the 1960s, the absolute assumption ground of evolutionary biology was Darwinian gradualism. The firm belief was that all genetic traits were inherited strictly through the nucleus of the cell, mutating very, very slowly over millions of years.
Right.
Margulis came in and proposed endosymbiosis, that a massive leap in cellular complexity happened because cells essentially absorbed whole other organisms and merged their machinery.
So she didn't just tweak a detail. She proposed a mechanism that completely bypassed the slow, gradual mutation they based their entire careers on. She denied the whole assumption ground.
And so she was labeled absurd. The only way an absurd theory transitions into an accepted stroke of genius is through overwhelming, undeniable proof over time.
Which is exactly what happened with her.
Yes. In Margulis's case, later advancements in technology allowed scientists to discover that mitochondria actually contain their own distinct DNA, entirely separate from the DNA in the nucleus of our cells.
Wow.
That physical evidence eventually forced the biological community to realize the lunatic was actually right.
It is a profound lesson on how the reception of your work is dictated by the audience's current reality. What is a mind-blowing revelation to a layperson is totally boring to an expert.
Mm-hmm.
And what is dismissed as utter madness today might be the foundational textbook knowledge of tomorrow.
Choosing the right question or the right project requires navigating all of these complex layers simultaneously.
So let's synthesize the checklist from these source notes. First, the internal test. You must be intrinsically motivated and fascinated by the problem so you possess the endurance to survive failure.
Check.
Second, the physical test, it must be feasible, meaning you have the basic tools and experimental system to take the first steps. Third, the contextual test, it shouldn't be a redundant race. You should be offering a unique value that wouldn't exist without you.
Right.
And finally, the communication test, your findings must defy the audience's expectations just enough to trigger their interest without shattering their reality so completely that they dismiss you as absurd.
It requires a delicate, constant balancing act between passion, pragmatism, and psychology. But when a researcher, or really any creator, manages to hit the center of that diagram, that is where truly transformative, paradigm-shifting work occurs.
And that is the framework we want you to take away from this deep dive.
Mm.
Whether you are outlining a PhD dissertation, pitching your restructuring plan to your board of directors, or just trying to figure out which side hustle deserves your weekend hours, run your idea through these exact filters.